Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Things have been continuing to percolate over in Syria. Some of the more disturbing things that are starting to happen is the conflict between Syria and Turkey with the shelling that's going across the border. There was also a report this week from Leon Panetta that we're going to send troops over onto the Jordanian border. What is this all leading to, Jim?
That nobody wants to actually get involved with the war. Everybody would like the rebels to win and for everything to quiet down, but nobody's willing to do much more than apply Band-Aids here and there. The Turks, with their own territory being attacked and Turkish citizens being killed, are doing nothing more than firing some artillery shells back and telling everybody that we're not going to invade Syria. So the situation has not changed. Inside Syria, the rebels are winning. The problem is that if they pay too high a price, nobody knows what too high is at this point, after they win, they're going to have a smoldering hatred for those fickle neighbors in the West, et cetera, for not helping them out. We did get a lot of goodwill in Libya for that air campaign. Obviously, it got our ambassador killed, but that was more the fault of the State Department than, Libya, which is still trying to get a government going. But Syria, is liable to have a bitter aftertaste. The problem is that while Arab countries are talking about intervening, Arab military leaders came right out and said, look, guys, we just ain't got it. It's humiliating to say, but and the pundits in the Arab media are sort of agreeing with it. A lot of these guys are Western educated, maybe even Strategy Page, users. They say, look, let's not embarrass ourselves, by trying to, intervene militarily. But that might still happen. They might still get an Arab, they could get an Arab air intervention force, based in Jordan, because basically Jordan's always been for rent. So they could simply, and that would definitely, clear the debt, as it were, that Jordan owes the rest of the Arab world for siding with Iraq in 1990. That still has a bitter taste, which can be assuaged by a little sweetness. But that's a long shot, even by Arab standards. NATO, France, says, hey, we should do something, but, the Russians are still there with their veto. So nothing's happening. And both sides, Syria has its fans, especially Russia, Iran, etc., the government there. And the rest of the world, of course, is behind the rebels, more or less. They're just basically observers. It's a death match. It's entertainment. I hate to use that word, but that's basically what they've relegated it to. They've basically boxed this whole situation and are just waiting for the participants to kill enough of each other to for one side to declare victory. Sad but true. That's what's happening there.
Austin?
Well, I don't think Jim's given a succinct and accurate assessment of the situation. Unless this is one line of analysis I think I would extend. That's Turkey. He's right that Turkey really does not want to commit troops to go across the border. It wants to use the threat of it to achieve political, using it as a diplomatic tool to pressure the Assad regime. And yet artillery exchanges, really based on, in my view, accidental mortar fire across the border. I don't think the Syrian army's targeting Turkish territory. Huge mistake. But they are targeting rebel positions, possibly rebel supply lines that are right crossing the border from Turkey. And you've had mortar rounds land in Turkish towns and kill Turkish citizens. And then the Turkish government responded in a way that you would expect the Turkish government to respond. Last I saw, they had been shelling Syrian army positions, mortar positions, possibly artillery positions. I saw one report referring to it as artillery, even though the more detailed reports always refer to it as Syrian mortars, but shelling those positions for 5 days. In other words, sustaining the counterattack. Side statement on this, I think some of the message isn't simply to Assad, it's a message to other actors in the Middle East, specifically Iran, which is if you really do fiddle with us, we'll shoot back and we'll continue to shoot back, and we'll shoot back on our timeline, not on yours. In other words, not what you would claim would be tit for tat. We will, it would be tit for your cat. And I think that's part of the message that the Turks are sending. But at the same time, this illustrates how volatile the situation is and how an escalation could occur, escalation by accident. Sorry, calling the example here of the Syrian mortar rounds hitting a Turkish city an accident, spillover violence, another way to look at it. Or there could be some precipitating event that's not, quote-unquote, necessarily an accident. You could see the rebels are a diffuse organization. You could see actors within their group try to set conditions for a clash between the Syrian army and the Turkish army. You could also see another potential actor, and this is a theoretical, Dan, a speculation, but within the Kurdistan Workers Party, PKK, there really are a couple of, of factions within the PKK in Syria, as well as within the PKK in general, and it's they operate on a Gavril Princip theory that it's chaos ensues, it's to our benefit, Gavril Princip being a fellow who assassin who killed Archduke Ferdinand in 1914. You see an actor like that try to precipitate the conflagration, which Jim says all the outside forces are trying to avoid. Part of the reason they're trying to avoid it is they don't know it is a conflagration. They don't know where it's going to end, and the Turks have, according to numerous things I've read since last fall, some things I've written as my own thinking about it, is the Turks are willing to rattle sabers rhetorically. They're willing to launch artillery forays. They're willing to look the other way as Persian Gulf Arab states supply arms to the Free Syrian Army. They're willing to look the other way and actually participate in it, if they participate in really what is a large-scale NATO covert action. Good, strong reports that the big U.S., big Turkish base at Incirlik, at Adana, has become something of a NATO spy base. There were one report of about 4 weeks ago of people citing individuals that identified as some of the top covert operatives of U.S., Turkey, and Great Britain, as well as some other NATO nation secret services operating out of that area, supposedly facilitating the sending of arms and intelligence to the Free Syrian Army. That was one of the accusations you saw out of the Assad government about that press release. And it follows because the secret services are going to be intimately, they're really the correct tool for the kind of situation that exists in Syria, for both monitoring it, gathering information, and also facilitating covert logistical support. Turks are doing all of that, but they don't want to actually commit to commit to a sustained intervention unless they've got full NATO support, and that doesn't obtain. They don't have a commitment from the United States, which would be the most important commitment to, on their view. And if you don't have the commitment of the United States, then whatever France and Great Britain say they will do is nice, but you have to have the U.S. Political and logistical, and also the at least the current threat of the U.S. military action to and your support to take on the kind of problem that Syria has. And everybody knows that. Everybody knows that you don't have that commitment from the U.S. and the rest of NATO. They understand Turkey's hesitancy. You see, from the flip side, if we're going to war game it, Iran sees all of that and says, oh, that's all in our favor, and yet the Iranians' ability to affect the situation in Syria is has deteriorated. They've tried their best shots at this point, which is, as we pointed out on Strategy Talk, several times, they provide logistical support, they provide financial support, they provided from their secret services advice on how to crush resistance movements. They may well have provided some degree of covert military assistance, and they've provided backup through their wholly owned subsidiary of Lebanese Hezbollah. There have been reports of Hezbollah activity inside Syria on behalf of the Assad government, and it has not put down, as Jim pointed out, has not put down the rebellion. It may have incited it. Even saw last week the Free Syrian Army say that they might just go after some of Hezbollah's assets inside of Lebanon. That's interesting. That's an indication that the Syrian government has at least probed the Lebanese border because they were claiming that the Free Syrian Army was receiving support through Lebanon. If they're willing to do that, maybe they would do the same thing with Jordan. And so it's not just prepping, you know, one of the aspects of U.S. forces in Jordan. It's not just there to help Jordan handle the refugee crisis, or as Jim explored a moment ago, an Arab intervention force. It's also perhaps a deterrent to Syrian troublemaking along the Jordanian border. Though if I were Assad, I wouldn't try to provoke anyone on the border. And then lastly, you've got the, I wouldn't say lastly here, but there's another dimension, the relationship with Iraq. Iraq has looked the other way as Iran has wanted to provide support for Syria, but Iraq is not a friend of the Assad government. And that's, when you deal with the Iraqis too, you also got the Kurd question, how the Kurds going to act with the Syrian situation. And that's the Kurd situation is a dimension that is a major factor in the way the Turks assess their interests in intervening in Syria. So I guess I've described in some more detail some of the complications that that Jim alluded to, and also the, you know, especially the NATO's reluctance, the huge factor in the way that the Turks will actually act as the situation continues.
Jim, why put American troops on the Jordanian border?
That's mostly humanitarian, plus intelligence gathering. The Jordanians and the United States and Israel have always had close but rather low-key relationships in terms of military exchanges, intelligence exchanges. The rest of the Arab world has basically come to accept that as long as it doesn't make the headlines. The Jordanians see it as essential. I mean, that's one reason why the Kingdom of Jordan survived, you know, backing, you know, Saddam early on in 1990. I mean, they switched sides, you know, quickly, but and they did that, again, because they have to survive. They have no oil. They got a lot of Palestinians. They got some, you know, Islamic fundamentalists. They got a bad situation. And they've managed to make the most of it. Now, of course, they've got thousands of, I forget what the number is, it's close to 100,000 Syrian refugees, some of whom are not behaving, you know, politely. And they need some help simply to handle a humanitarian situation in when they themselves haven't got a lot of resources. So they're more than happy to have our guys come in and help them interview the Syrian military-age guys who come across the border, which is what they have been doing. I think they've been getting some help from the Saudis on that. But that is a great source of intelligence. And, you know, we just decided to announce that there are going to be more Americans over there so the media doesn't get a hold of it and start, you know, spinning all sorts of paranoid, you know, tales. It's basically very common in Jordan, and I think that was handled very well by the military, you know, PR people. It'll diffuse a lot of, you know, useless, you know, spinning, you know, by journalists who should know better, but alas, do not, which is why we have so many readers. That's strategy page.
Now, are those special forces troops, Jim, or are they, since they're normally dealing with that type of thing?
It's interesting. They didn't go into details on exactly what kind of troops. So it may very well have been special forces, although the Arabic-speaking special forces guys are rather overworked at this point. It might have been, you know, simply the army is trying to organize, how should I put it, not civil affairs, but humanitarian, you know, relief, you know, troops, as well as training brigades to specialize in specific commands around the world, specific regions like the special forces have always done. They haven't, so it's anybody's guess unless, you know, I can get somebody, you know, one of our contributors, as it were, our sources, you know, in that area. I have one guy in Jordan, but he's far, far away from the border, and he's hard to get a hold of these days. You know, we're just going to have to wait until something leaks out.
I wanted to add one thing, pick up on something that Jim had said earlier when we kicked off the program about Jordan's comparative isolation due to its legacy of supporting Saddam in 1990. That really kicked the Saudis off, because one of the things King Hussein said at the time is he briefly referred to himself as Sharif Hussein, which is a code word for being the Sharif of. You remember that, Jim?
Well, bad blood between Hashemites in Jordan and the Saudis goes back centuries. So this is an old feud.
All right, well, look, he's the Hashemites, and the Hashemites are the royal family in Jordan at what time ruled the Hejaz, which is Western Saudi Arabia, Western.
But they were working for the Turks, so that got them a collaborator tag, you know, in Arabia.
Right, it's where Mecca is. They also claim to be descendants of the Prophet, just as the royal family in Morocco has. So that's the claim, and there's still a line of thought through much of Islam, you know, realizing that they're Sunnis, and this is a sometimes called a Shia claim. If we're going to get email about this, I can back it up. Is that it needed to be someone of a relative or of Muhammad should have been the spiritual and the political leader, and so some of this at least flows in as a strengthening of the right of the royal families to rule. But it sent the Saudis up that when Hussein called himself Sharif Hussein, because he would be the Sharif of Mecca, in other words, the protector of Mecca. And recall in August and September of 1990 that there were, you know, indications that maybe the Iraqis were going all the way to Riyadh, and that would have really changed the political face of Arabia and perhaps opened a path for the return of the Hashemites to the Hejaz. Well, it didn't happen. Jordan, and that's not the only reason Jordan supported Iraq. Jordan's port of Aqaba had served as the second port after Basra for Iraq. It has a super highway running up there that runs up through Jordan and then through western Iraq all the way to Baghdad. And there are economically tied to Iraq. They're still economically tied to Iraq. Doesn't matter who's in charge in Iraq. There's the economic ties with Jordan are quite close. But they made a mistake, and now didn't make a total mistake. There are plenty of examples of the Jordanians being reintegrated with the other Arab states, Persian Gulf Arab states, since 1990. But here's an opportunity to get back in good graces with other Arabs, and in our case, other Bedouin Arabs. Well, Arab, Arabian Peninsula Arabs. And that's part of what Jim alluded to that. I think that's what's going on. There's also the dimension is they are on the border of Syria, and they've got the refugee crisis. Jim mentioned the intelligence gathering. I am going to bring back again where I said some degree of a deterrence effect of actually putting NATO troops, U.S. troops, NATO troops as logistics facilitators, some deterrent effect with that on the ground. And then Jordan's ties to the U.S. and Great Britain are longstanding. So you've got the Assads are really pinned. They really are pinned, and they know it. The thing is, those they're desperate, they're vicious, they're violent, and they have made made real a commitment that Gaddafi did rhetorically. I guess he really did ultimately carry it out. He was going to fight to the death, you know. Well, Gaddafi.
But the Assads are also greedy because corruption is the major indoor corruption is the major indoor sport in Syria and has been since Roman times. When things started to go, you know, sideways in Syria, you know, some countries, the neighbors, the other Arab states, especially the Sunni, you know, Saudi Arabia, they were making offers to Syria, to the Assads, where they could get out with some of their, you know, money and dignity intact. But no, the Assads were basically told by the Iranians that, you know, we will back you, but, they made a wrong decision because I don't think they're going to get out of this one. They haven't got enough firepower. They've got the majority of the population up in arms against them. You know, they're playing a real long shot, you know, but you gamble in this game and you lose your dead, literally.
Well, this is why you see speculative articles, I don't know, or suspected it, about an Alawite genocide if and when the Assads finally lose, unless they're...
Well, that's where it's headed for. I mean, that's why the Alawites were all fleeing to the Alawite homeland along the coast, you know, north of Lebanon there, south of Turkey, because that way they can at least be close to a ship.
Yeah, or an Alawite, try to make an Alawitistan, I suppose, is another...
Well, the plan B is Alawitistan, and plan C is, you know, we're close to the coast, you know, we're lining up charter ships to get us all out of here. Now, where they're going to land is an interesting question, but...
All right, so they go to Cyprus. Cyprus is your first stop if you're fleeing, because then I don't think they're going to Turkey. Where do they go from there?
Iran.
They always go from there. They go to Iran. Well, that's
good luck with that. Iran has become turned into a real garden spot, you know, with huge unemployment, huge inflation, and no end in sight.
And I think Iran could well be the longest of long shots for them. The longest of long shots. They're playing long shots wherever they go.
Well, they are wheeling and dealing. People I know in the oil business are watching this with great interest, because Iran is basically offering real cheap deals on oil if people are willing to take the risk of, you know, running afoul of the sanctions. Because if you do get caught, Iranian oil, you know, you can be hurt really bad economically. You know, in some countries there can even be criminal, you know, prosecution. So the Iranians are all over the East Asia, you know, looking for people who are, you know, willing to take a chance. And gambling is very popular in East Asia. So, you know, they may indeed end up finding a way, an alternate way to unload their oil you know, at a discount, but still be able to get the oil out, and that'll be up to the rest of the world to come up with more sanctions. And of course, Iran is hoping that eventually they get the nuclear weapon, at which point the sanctions will magically fall away because nobody will mess with them.
That's what they think. That's their bet, Jim.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to mess with them once they have a nuclear weapon.
Are they in for a surprise?
They could be in for the biggest surprise, and that it doesn't do for them what they think it will do. It does the opposite.
And Iranians, whom I know a number of, are basically saying they're hoping that eventually the supporters of the minority, about 20% of the population that supports the religious dictatorship, will become demoralized and say, well, look, we'll try something else. This obviously isn't working, although it's great for Islam. You know, I can't feed my kids. And that's a long way coming, because the first people who get what little resources there are those supporters who are mostly poor country people to begin with. So they're low maintenance, as it were. But that's what Iranians, and a lot of Iranians are making a decent living. You know, it's harder now with the exchange rate, you know, on the real is just killing a lot of families, a lot of family businesses. But they don't want another civil war. They don't want another war. The losses of the 1980s still resonate, even though most Iranians were born after that. But you still have enough parents and grandparents say, you don't want this. You do not want that again. Keeping you from breaking out into another civil war.
What Jim's outlined there about the even the 10%, 15% that supports the Ayatollah regime, changing there is kind of analogous to a perestroika glasnost.
Yes, they are encouraged by what happened in 89 and 91.
Right.
And in several other places since then. But so far, I mean, that was the Green Revolution. What was it, last year, 2 years ago? They thought that would be their moment. Didn't happen. They said, weren't there yet.
That's exactly why they were so afraid of it, Jim. It was June 2009. It's because you had a mass movement that had, look, we don't want a bloodbath, but we've got to change. And they repressed it. And guess what? U.S. government didn't provide, or was very, very slow in providing a moral support and political support to the Green Movement. They got a freebie 60 to 90 days right as the support was building. Well, you can't relive history, but there was a moment right there. That moment may reappear because the problems of, despite some of the things that have gone on in the last 3 years that the Ayatollahs see as positive, that the problem hadn't gone away. So.
Yeah, and I think we can basically say, bring back 89. It was a great year.
Well, we'll wrap it up there, Jim and Austin, and move on. Thanks for being here today.